And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/theathletic.
Everybody, welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens on this June 25th, 2021. And the Montreal Canadiens are going to the Stanley Cup Finals. Arpan Basu, hello, my friend. How are you today?
How's it going?
Oh, my. Well,
what's new?
I don't know. I was looking at the news, you know. I thought Pascal Vincent's hiring in Columbus is interesting.
It's a bombshell. What are you talking about? This is huge news.
I know.
We have to get into that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll dedicate a whole segment to it today. No. all kidding aside, congratulations to Pascal. But listen, bombshell in Montreal yesterday night on Saint-Jean-Baptiste Day, the Montreal Canadiens reached the Stanley Cup Finals for the first time since 1993. 28 years later, the wait is over. They slayed the, to use a popular expression in Vancouver, they sort of slayed the dragon by beating a team that was once again largely favorite, and they did so in a way that I wouldn't say that they were never in doubt, although they will say that they never doubted. But I think that this team showed a lot of extraordinary amount of resilience and showed that the Golden Knights were not quite ready for what the Montreal Canadiens was prepared to, you know, to confront them with.
Yeah, which is what made it the winning goal so appropriate. You know, I mean, we went through these whole playoffs and, you know, talking about, oh, Brendan Gallagher, oh, he's going to get one soon. And the focus is always on the production. But, you know, the line of Lekkonen and Dano and Gallagher, you know, completely, you know, neutering, like just totally making a non-factor of Mark Stone and to a somewhat lesser extent Max Pacioretty, but Mark Stone in particular.
Yeah.
And doing it for a third series in a row, you know, having Phil Deneau and Brendan Gallagher play against Matthews and Marner and then Wheeler and Ehlers and now Stone and Pacioretty and having the same result happen three times in a row, that line deserves a lot of credit for that. And it allows the other lines to get easier matchups and allows them to take care of more of the production. But for that line, all three members of that line to combine on the winning goal immediately following a sneaky good save by Carey Price that I don't think enough people pay attention to. But that shot from Alec Martinez was heading bar down, it seemed like. Like, that was a difficult save. And you know, he stayed up for it, got it with his shoulder or whatever it was. But tough save. They come down the other way. And actually, just prior to that, Max Pacioretty having a golden opportunity to win the game and not winning the game.
No.
To have Gallagher and Danault get through the neutral zone the way they did, the way they have for years, for Danault to attract all the attention to him and then send it back to Lehkonen and have Lehkonen finish on a chance when he's just completely berated all the time about his inability to finish on chances. But the importance of that line, for that line to come together, score that goal at that moment, was really just perfect in terms of rewarding the people that had a very, very big role but did not get probably enough credit for the Canadians being where they were.
You mentioned the fact that they've done that for three series in a row. Well, Dano, when he's on the ice with Gallagher, the two of them together, of course, they've had a rotation of wingers to complete their line. They've had Tatar, they've had Jake Evans, now they've got Lehkonen. Lehkonen's been with them for the majority of the time, but in close to 180 minutes of 5-on-5 play, Gallagher and Dano together have not given up a single goal.
I know, it's remarkable. And so, when you consider who they're facing, and when you consider they're starting all their shifts or the vast majority of their shifts in the defensive zone against the players that I mentioned earlier, like, it's a bonkers stat. Like, it's just crazy. And obviously, listen, Carey Price has a lot to do with that, but still, it's really incredible to see what those guys have done. And frankly, it's you know, I mean, we don't want to get to off-season stuff, but, you know, it's the value of Philip Danault is the big million-dollar question for this organization. And you can always point to the offensive numbers and say, oh, well, he doesn't deserve X number of dollars because look at this production. He's not a very offensive guy, more of a checker. How much do checkers get paid? Blah, blah, blah. Well, and we all thought that Philip Danault had made a huge mistake turning down an extension prior to the season that sounded pretty lucrative. Well, has anyone boosted their UFA status more than Philip Danault over the last three rounds? Like, honestly, good for you. Bet on yourself, buddy. And he did that, and it's paying off because he is just an incredibly smart and determined hockey player, and he is extremely valuable in times like this. And so I am very happy that he not only, you know, created, was probably the most responsible for that overtime winning goal. His play was the key play on that goal. But I'm also happy that he's going to wind up with a pizza sponsorship of some sort out of this.
No doubt.
He's managed to create endorsement dollars for himself while also playing extremely good hockey in the playoffs. So good for you, Philip Danault. That's two for two, betting on yourself in two ways, on the business side and on the ice. And he has nailed it in both cases.
Yeah, he's taken a page out of PK's playbook on that one.
The Listerine moment, except it kind of blew up in PK's face. I think Phil's handling it a little bit better right now.
Yes, he is. But, you know, what was Jacques Lemaire's line on Wes Waltz back in the day, that he's a 30-goal scorer for us, he scores 15 and he prevents 15?
Right.
So there's something about that related to that, to Dan, when it comes to Dano. And I was thinking, you know, because all those comparisons to 1993 obviously have been resurfacing for better or for worse, because you could argue, you know, that 86 is a better comparison.
It's a lazy comparison.
Which one? This 93?
The 93, yeah.
Yeah.
Just so happens it's the last one. Like, it's anyhow,
exactly. Guy Carbonneau was on that team. And do you think that somewhere the way that Philip Danault is playing sort of rehabilitates the defensive line center, like not his line, because it's a two-way line. I mean, it's meant to be productive, and during the regular season it normally is. It's been, at least with Gallagher and Tatar on that unit. But when come when come playoff time, it's clearly more a checking unit, very effective at it, and there's true value to it. So even though that line tries to play as much as possible in the other end, and that attacking that remains the best defense, isn't there somewhere in the way that Dano plays the game a little bit of a throwback in there, you think?
Yeah, a little bit, but not at the same time. You know, like, okay, if we want to make the comparisons to 93, think of Guy Carbonneau back then.
You know, Carbo could score goals. People forget that, but he could score goals.
He could score goals, and he did score goals, but in the playoffs, he really became exclusively a checker. Like, the difference between Philippe Dano and a traditional checking center is that, you know, Philippe Dano doesn't shadow anyone. He doesn't play without the puck all the time. You know, I think that's what checkers used to do, is that they would just kind of concede the fact that they're not going to have the puck this shift, and they're just going to do everything in their power to make sure that whoever they're facing, which is usually the best player on the other team, is not going to score. And that's their only mission. You could argue that that's also the mission of the Dano line, and it is, but they go about it a different way. Their goal is to have the puck in the offensive zone and to stay there as much as possible. And when they're playing at their best, that's what they do. They haven't done that all the time, but that is their method, is to create turnovers, to forecheck up ice. It's preventing those offensive players from being in the Canadian zone. And once they're there, that's where his smarts come in, because there's very few players out there who are better at closing passing lanes, putting sticks on pucks, getting tipping passes out of danger. Like, he is phenomenal at making sure that nothing gets through that slot area, the Royal Road, as it were, to lead to high danger opportunities on his goaltender. And so, but yeah, he's a throwback in his role, I think. I don't know how many traditional, like, you know, definitely one single-minded checking lines there are anymore in the NHL, but he goes about that role in a pretty modern way, I find.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a valid point there. Also on his line, Arturi Lehkonen, you mentioned the fact that he's been berated over time for lacking those that finishing skill and not seizing the opportunities that he was handed over and over, and he ends up scoring the biggest goal of his life, the biggest goal so far in the last 28 years for the Canadiens. I think that for a guy who's entering a new phase in his career, you know, you were mentioning the offseason, Lehkonen's going to be a restricted UFA, but he's up for a new contract. And he's always been so much of a better player in the playoffs than in the regular season that, you know, I was listening to a colleague, an out-of-town colleague that was covering the game last night. He said, this Lehkonen kid, yeah, well, this Lehkonen kid has been in the league for a few years now. He's not exactly a newcomer, yeah. But it's, at the same time, there's some people that were not really paying attention that see him in a different way. And I'm thinking, is it finally the time where Lehkonen can use these playoffs to really jumpstart his career or bringing it to another level, and by showcasing what he can really become during the playoffs? And if it's a reality for him, I think it would be great, because he's a coach's player, he's a teammate's player, everybody loves him within hockey circles. It's just that the fans have grown irritated over time with his lack of finish, which incidentally was the first reason why he was drafted in the first place, because when he was in juniors, he was a sniper and he had a great shot. And that was, I mean, had it not been for the two concussions he suffered in the same season, in his draft season, he would have been a first round pick. And he arrives in the NHL, scores 18 goals in his rookie season, and all of a sudden, after that, it sort of evaporated. But here's to Arturi Lehkonen rekindling his scoring touch, and hopefully can you know, reconnect with that part of that game, of his game, thanks to that goal he scored last night. I really wish that for him.
Well, Okay, I'm gonna go on a little rant now. here's my thing with Arturi Lehkonen, okay? And I'm gonna, you know, maybe a bit of a spoiler, but I just got off the phone with his dad, Ismo, who, who's I'm friendly with. I stayed at his house when I went to Finland, and he is a hockey guy through and through. He's a coach. He's a big reason. Brendan Gallagher said it last week, how Lehkonen clearly benefited from good coaching as a kid, and his dad had a lot to do with it, and he did. But you know, a lot of the details of the game that Lehkonen displays are thanks to his upbringing. He had a brother who was excellent at hockey, his older brother, and that really pushed him along, and learned some of the finer points of the game as a kid. So talking to him this morning, he said something that's interesting. We're gonna have a story on this in The Athletic on Friday. Is that he didn't think that he was like, Arturi would never be the player he is today had he not gone to Sweden when he went to go play with Frölunda in Gothenburg, which is like just across the bay from his hometown in Turku. And that's where he learned how to be a defensive player and how to learn, you know, he was put on the fourth line there and learned a checking game in the Swedish system. And it really transformed him from the player that you described, a goal scorer, power play guy, just a purely offensive guy, to a very complete player. But this is my thing about Lehkonen is, can we stop hoping he becomes something else than what he is? What he is a very valuable player. Like, he's a good player. He will never be a 25 goal scorer in the NHL, even though he looks like he has the skills to do it. But at this point, the sample size is large enough that it's probably not going to happen. And I think once people get their heads around that and just be like, what he is a middle to bottom six, effective checker who is extremely disruptive on the forecheck, is never caught out of position, is an extraordinarily responsible player in his own end, and can chip in some offense from time to time. And this is the most valuable part, when the playoffs arrive, invariably, without exception, his game goes up a level. And so that in itself is valuable. Like, having that guy, a guy who's able to flip a switch when the playoffs come around and become a better version of himself, I mean, that's what you're looking for. That's what you want. And so I feel like Lehkonen's time in Montreal has always been predicated on what he's not, as opposed to what he is. And what he is a valuable guy who's just a middle of the lineup guy, and that's fine. And then once the playoffs come around, he becomes this beast who just like is impossible to play. There's like listen, Deno's going to get a lot of the credit for Mark Stone's very tepid series against the Canadiens, having done nothing. The guy lining up opposite Mark Stone is Arturi Lehkonen. That's the guy who is lining up at a faceoff. When Mark Stone looks up, he's looking at Arturi Lehkonen. And he had a big role to play in him doing nothing as well.
That's a nice rant there, man.
Sorry, I had to get it off my chest.
That's good. That's what we're there for. We're going to take calls after that.
It's therapy. Yeah, it's our therapy session. But I do feel like it's frustrating to see to what extent the narrative around Lehkonen is always, oh, he can't score. Oh, he can't do this. Oh, he can't do that. But look at what he can do. He can do so many other things that help a team win. And his teammates have always appreciated those things far more than the outside world has. And now, I mean, good for him for getting rewarded and for finishing that chance. But yet again, playoff Lehkonen is a thing. And it's showing again.
Well, I agree with everything you said. It's just that I remember that when he signed his last contract, I spoke to people who said he has chosen to bet on himself. That's the term that had been used. And I think that he himself thought that he could be more than what he had shown so far. So there's also the component of, does he come to term with who he is at this point in his career, accept what he has been so far and what he's able to contribute, and just be the best version possible of himself? I think that there would be nothing wrong to that, because as you aptly demonstrated, he's got plenty to bring to the table.
And it should be noted that he was scratched during the season. So it's not just the when I say the outside world needs to accept, it's not just the outside world. Dominique Ducharme himself did not want him in his lineup for a while earlier this season. And frankly, he wasn't playing all that great at the time. But I think Ducharme and the whole organization recognizes to what extent the Lekkonen that we see now is there. It's in him. And they have that. So it's a matter of, you know, the same discussion happens with Nick Suzuki. Like, you know, I saw the other day Sean LaFortune, who works with the Owen Sound Attack, put out a tweet that was marking the anniversary of the Vegas Golden Knights picking Nick Suzuki, and he put out all these comments that he was getting in Suzuki's draft year, like, oh, he's not fast enough, nice junior player, don't know if it'll translate, blah, 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 blah. And he was like, credit the Vegas Golden Knights for seeing what Suzuki can be as opposed to what he wasn't. They traded him, yes, but that's another case of a guy where he's been defined by what he's not. The speed thing has always followed Nick Suzuki around. For some reason, he's considered a small player. The guy's like 210 pounds. Is perfectly he's solid.
My God.
He's solid. Yeah. He's just a solid player, not small by any stretch of the imagination, and very difficult to knock off the puck. You know, and so, again, a case of a guy who is largely defined by what he isn't as opposed to what he is, which is just a highly, highly intelligent hockey player who, again, like Lekkonen, has a history of raising his game in the playoffs. And here he is playing great and centering the Canadiens' number one offensive line and being a big reason why that line has been able to produce offense and has been effective.
Right. This team seems assembled around guys who can raise their game in the playoffs. I mean, it's quite obvious now when you look at you know, the acquisition of Corey Perry and, you know, so many other guys. Joel Armia has been a force for the Montreal Canadiens in the playoffs. You mentioned Suzuki. Paul Byron seems to be a mirror image of Arturi Lekkonen in terms of, or an older version in the sense that he's this middling forward in the regular season on and in and out of the lineup, and comes playoff time, whoa, he's like, he raises his game using his own tools, which are not the same as Lekkonen, although there are some that are similar, but and bring you really this to another level. Same for on defense, same with Ben Chiarot. The Ben Chiarot of the regular season versus the Ben Chiarot that we see now, it's almost two different players. With the we see the Ben Chiarot right now that a lot similar to the one we saw in the bubble last year. Prior to last night's game, he was the Canadiens' most used player. I'm sure that when they acquired him and they signed him 2 years ago, nobody would have thought in their right mind that the Canadiens would reach the Stanley Cup Finals, A, and within that period of time, and B, that Ben Chiarot would be their most used player. So it goes to show how different the regular season and the playoffs are. And there are some teams that are juggernauts during the regular season, and they create the envy of the people saying, oh my God, they're building this powerhouse. You know, well, obviously Toronto comes to mind. For the longest time, the San Jose Sharks were like that. Well, yeah. I wonder those teams.
Colorado's like that right now.
Yes, exactly. And those teams that have such an impressive success in the regular season and repeat it year after year, it sort of create comfort for the people saying, well, they're doing something right, because year after year, they're there. You know, they're contenders for the President Cup, the President's Trophy. Uh-huh. Well, I wonder how many of those teams would trade those President's Trophy and all those points that they gathered during the regular season for the chance that the Canadiens have given themselves. And that, I think that is a credit to Marc Bergevin. We both touched on it in our respective piece last night. But when you look at how, I will dare to say, stubborn Marc Bergevin was in keep building this team around Carey Price and Shea Weber, despite the fact that they were, aging assets. They were guys that were costing them a lot of money on the under the cap. you know, up and down performances. Yet Bergevin decided that they would remain his two pillars. It might not work every year. It might work only this year, and this team might miss the playoffs next year. But if it works only one year, and this would be the year, all this thing of building around Weber and Price will have been worthy of doing it.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And another thing, you mentioned Bergevin being stubborn. And so here's where the stubbornness is really paying off, is that, and here's where I actually commend Bergevin, because, and you know, I think we both kind of said it, or maybe, I don't know, it's I felt this, is that, you know, in acquiring Sherratt and Edmondson and with Petrie and Weber, he was going against the league-wide grain. Like, he was going against the trend in the league of adding faster, more offensive style defensemen, with the knowledge that players like this on defense pay off in the playoffs when you have to play them over and over and over again. Ben Sherratt being a perfect example. And then doubling down on that by going out and getting Joel Edmondson to create the top four that he has is not typical of how NHL teams were building their defenses over the last couple of years. And you look at the final four teams, they all have that. I mean, yes, Alex Pietrangelo and Shea Theodore are you know, marvelously talented players, but two bigger guys. Braden McNabb is their Ben Sherratt, basically. And Alec Martinez, who was phenomenal in the playoffs, played a very physical brand of hockey, kind of big, tough, sort of stay-at-home-ish, even though he has some offensive skill. But, you know, that's Vegas, the Islanders, the Pelech-Pulak pairing is fantastic. You look at and then they have Andy Green playing still. He's still playing hockey, and he's still playing it at a level that you know has the potential to reach the Stanley Cup final.
I think he's the last player that played for the world the World Association, right?
He looks like it at least. And then you have Tampa, you know, who had last year added Bogosian, was a big part of their Cup run. This, you know, and obviously Hedman's in a class alone as far as quality of defenseman, but like adding Ryan McDonagh was a big reason why that was a big step for Tampa to take. Like, it was adding McDonagh and then getting Coleman and Gaudreau. But still, you know, Cernak, Ruda, like they have big, robust, heavy defensemen. And Bergevin identified this a while ago. You could argue he identified it when he traded Subban for Weber. Like, it's like, it's, and he was criticized for it because everyone's like, oh, you're just going out and getting defensemen like you were, you know, like you're going out and getting guys like the way you played. And maybe that's true, but I just feel like this is something that he identified and that he stuck with, despite everyone saying that he is stuck in the past or stuck in a different era of hockey, and it's working. Like, you can't deny that the Canadiens' top four on defense was great and has been great throughout these playoffs. And Shea Weber might have played his best game in Game 6 against Vegas. Like, that was,
oh, yeah,
that was classic vintage Shea Weber. He was phenomenal. So, and you know, there are some mitigating factors. Weber getting injured allowed him some rest. Even Price getting injured allowed him some rest. And so, there, you know, you had rested players going in, but the general philosophy of building the defense was stubborn, as you said, and it was stubborn in a way that's paying off now.
You know, every year we say how it's a copycat league, and whoever's got success, the other teams will try to see what where that success comes from and which lessons they can take out of it. And I think that what you just mentioned about the defensemen is probably something that will be reconsidered by other teams, because it's not sexy. I mean, everybody would like to have Cale Makar on their team, and it would make hockey so much more exciting, so much more offensive, dynamic, and you want a guy who's going to be a perennial Norris Trophy candidate on your team. But the reality is not every team will have a Cale Makar, and at some point, if you, instead of having a sub Cale Makar, you have to build your decor differently. And I think that was a nifty way to go about it for the Montreal Canadiens, and to a certain extent, you could say that up front, building it weak link type, building on depth was probably the best way for them to overcome the fact that they didn't have any superstar up front. And so you have to look at what you got and how can you make the most out of the group that you have without tearing it apart completely, because you can never start from scratch close to. So yeah. It's how are you going to maximize what you got, the players that are good on your team, and allow them to flourish. And I think that even though the Canadiens are not playing the type of hockey that some fans would like to see, because they would like to see some open, offensive, exciting brand of hockey, it works. And I think that I wrote a column on that. I think it was at the end of when they beat Toronto, or I don't know which, at the end of first round or second round, one of the two. It's just that there's a portion of the Canadian fan base that seemed irritated or annoyed at the fact that the Canadians were winning without, and they wished that the Canadians had won a different way, that they won with a different brand of hockey, that they won with a different general manager with different ideas in place. And in the meantime, they were sort of ignoring the potential fun that they could have in watching this game, this team win and enjoying success. Now I think that everybody's on board with that, and you have to come to the conclusion that even if you have your reservations toward Marc Bergevin, there's the decisions that he made are paying off now. And we've been very critical of Marc Bergevin, but you got to recognize at some point that his team's in Stanley Cup final. He must have done something right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Must have done something right. And this is, there is this overwhelming sense that the Canadians play like a conservative defensive brand of hockey. They're not the most aggressive team, but they're not conservative. I don't think that's a fair description of how they play. What they do is if there's one thing to describe the way this team plays, I would say they play a high pressure brand of hockey. Like when they don't have the puck, they're going to pressure it, and they're going to force you into mistakes, and then they will try to capitalize on those mistakes. So yes, it's a counterattacking style. It's a style predicated on creating turnovers, but it's not conservative in the sense that they are aggressively defensive, if that makes sense. Like they play defense with an aggression all over the ice. So there's not a moment where you have the puck and you can just relax and take your time and make a decision. That's not happening. There's a guy on you at all times. And over 7 games or 6 games or 5 games or 4 games, that wears on a team. It wears on the top players. Perfect example is watch Alex Pietrangelo over the course of this series. He was phenomenal. He was great. But as the series went along, Brendan Gallagher was becoming a very big nuisance to that guy. Like Gallagher hit him every single chance he had, and he's like a gnat. It's just like, get away from me. And eventually, the plays Pietrangelo was making earlier in the series became fewer and far between because he was just getting rid of the puck. He was not making the plays that he wanted to make because he knew that this gnat was coming, and it started affecting his decision making. And that's effective in the playoffs, where you can have a cumulative effect on players' decision making because of the way you play. That's what playoff hockey is. That's how you approach a series. is I'm going to make sure that the what I do is going to impact what he's doing, and it's going to make him do something that he'd rather not do. And we saw it in the Leafs series. We saw it in the Jets series to a lesser extent, but we definitely saw it in the Vegas series, because the cumulative effect on Pietrangelo, I found, made him less effective as the series went along. Still great, let's be clear. Still probably the best player in the series overall, but less and less effective as the series went along. Don't even have to talk about Stone. The guy who's not getting talked about a lot is Jonathan Marchessault, who I thought every time he had the puck, he bobbled it, or he was trying to do something too quickly, or he was shooting it 2 feet over the net when he's alone in the slot. Like, he just, his decision-making was completely rewired by the Canadians. And that's, I feel like that's their style. So this notion that they're conservative and that it's bad for hockey, I really disagree with. It's not conservative. It's trying to impact another team's ability to think. And I think they do it quite effectively.
And also the other thing on top of that is the fact that for the first time in a generation, if not two, the Canadians are not the little small fast team anymore. It's physically a bigger team. Yes. And his ability to play physical, to hit the opponent, to force them to get rid of the puck. We saw it against Toronto. You know, you mentioned Jake Muzzin on numerous occasions, how he would just get rid of the puck. In this Vegas series, we saw that with Max Pacioretty. The Canadians are relentless in applying not only a pressure with their stick, but applying a physical pressure too. And that's something that we're not necessarily accustomed to, the Canadians. And it's, I mean, going back in time, of course, back in the day in the 80s with Robinson, Ludwig, Green, they were big back then. But for the past 25 years, that was not the case. And this year, apart from that short-lived and really clumsy attempt at making the team bigger in 2013,
Michael McCarron draft.
Yes, but I mean...
The Arturi Lekkonen draft.
Yes, that's how we should call it now. No, but yes. I'm referring to Douglas Murray, you know.
Right, yeah.
Yes, and then... And then Dwight King, was it in 2013 or 2015? But anyway,
that was 2015. Dwight King 2015. And Steve Ott, and yeah,
that's it. So there's
whole
been
group, yeah.
So yeah, so Marc Bergevin had some attempts to try to fix that, but not in a very effective way. It was rather clumsy and counterproductive for the team. But this time around, we see a team that's, when we, you know, the number of times that on this podcast and in our articles, we mentioned how the Canadians had been built for the playoffs. Well, that's one key component to it. And that's where you see Josh Anderson being a reflection of that. That's where you see Eric Staal raising his level and bringing his whole line, that fourth line, playing a brand of hockey that is another thing that we're not accustomed to in Montreal. Having a line that does so much cycling, it's not a type of hockey that we've been very familiar with in Montreal over years. So I think that there's something very different about this team this season. And it's not just because of the fact that they've had success and they're reaching the finals, but in the way they're built, there's something refreshing. And it's like, you know how people like to bring up that quote from Albert Einstein, that the definition of insanity is trying the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. Well, they tried something different this year instead of trying the same thing over and over, and they got a different result.
Yes, they did. And let's give credit where it's due. I mean, also that Marc Bergevin for years was lambasted in this market for not spending to the cap. Grilled over the coals because the Montreal Canadiens should be spending to the cap. They're the Montreal Canadiens. They should be spending to the cap. Act like you're the Montreal Canadiens. Well, you know, being stupid is not what the Montreal Canadiens are all about. You know, it's like you don't stupidly spend to the cap for the sake of spending to the cap. You do it when you have players to spend the money on. You know, spending to the cap for the sake of spending to the cap is when you wind up with Carl Alzner signings. You know, with all due respect to Carl, love the guy, but it was a bad contract. It was a bad signing. Those are the types of mistakes you make when you're spending for the sake of spending. Marc Bergevin did not do that. And I think the Carl Alzner contract taught him a lesson to a certain extent that I should not do that. I am going to spend the money when I have an appropriate player to spend it on. This summer presented that opportunity. The pandemic, everything it entailed, the financial ruin it had on the league, how no teams had any money to spend. All of a sudden, Marc Bergevin is sitting there with cap space. You can get Tyler Toffoli for $4.25 million. What a bargain. Who'd have thought? You know, you could get, you just so happen to have a disgruntled player in Columbus and you have a disgruntled player in Montreal. Why don't we swap disgruntled players? And I can get my power forward. You can get your playmaking center in Max Domi. Boom, Josh Anderson. And who has the cap space to sign him to a big fat extension? Marc Bergevin does. Credit to him. He did not wither. He was stubborn. Again, stubborn in the face of constant criticism that the Canadians are playing like this small, or are being managed like a small market team. All Jeff Molson cares about is making money, and he's not letting him spend money on players. All he cares about is $17 beers, blah, blah, blah. Marc Bergevin waited for the moment to spend the money and did it pretty darn well in that offseason and deserves credit for it. To get Toffoli and Anderson and Edmondson and Jake Allen and Corey
Edmondson,
Perry.
Edmondson looks like a real bargain. Honestly,
he looks like a bargain, and Bergevin was roasted for that signing, and hands up, like, I did not like it. Not one bit. Did not think it was a smart move. The one thing that made me believe that maybe let's give it a chance is that Ben Chiarot turned out a lot better than I thought he would when he was signed, because I didn't like that move either. So that was my only benefit of the doubt moment with Edmondson, was like, I don't like this. This doesn't look very smart, but I didn't think Chiarot looked very smart either. So let's wait and see. That was the only thing that had any redeeming quality in that signing as far as I was concerned. But still, to get all those players I just mentioned in a single offseason, to have them all playing roles right now, including Jake Allen, because honestly, the Canadiens do not make the playoffs without him, is remarkable. Like, that is a translation of an offseason to a Stanley Cup final unlike we have really seen very often in recent history.
And you haven't mentioned Corey Perry in there.
I did mention Corey Perry. At the end. You could check the tape.
Okay. Yes, I did. Okay.
But still, okay. Corey Perry, you know, a week before training camp starts, decides to sign with Montreal because they're the only team offering him a non-tryout contract, jumps in his car and drives from London, Ontario to Montreal to come to training camp, and is, you know, did not see his wife and kid since, and is a vital piece. You know, you talked about that fourth line. Like, you know, between him and Armia, like, you know, Staal's playing great. And I think Staal's play, you know, along the boards, definitely below the goal line, has been really exemplary in this series. But, you know, Perry and Armia are dynamic players. Like, they're not just cycle players. They're doing dynamic things with the puck and they're creating chances. And so,
yeah.
But yeah, it's rare you see such an active offseason reflect itself so glaringly in the immediate playoffs, immediately after that offseason. It usually takes a little bit more time than this.
All right, I'm going to switch gears here for a second, and I'm just thinking of that. A reader was asking me if there had been cheers in the press box, like when the Canadians won and all that. And I thought, that's weird that I watched that whole thing unfold, and to a certain extent, is it me who's dead inside? But I reacted the same way as if it was a 3-2 win against Columbus in November. How did you feel? How did you live that moment when it happened yesterday?
I mean, to be honest, I can't. Well, you know, we're not supposed to celebrate. We're objective observers and all that stuff. But more than that, you know, we have a job to document it. I was consumed with that. I was consumed with the notion that I don't want to miss anything. I was trying to watch everything at once. And in so doing, I was watching nothing. I was just jumping around. My eyes were jumping all over the ice. I wanted to see everyone's reactions. I wanted to make sure I caught something happening on the ice that I could write about. And that's all. I was consumed with that. 100% of my brain was like, don't screw this up. Like, this is a big deal. What's going on right now? I've covered this team for 21 years now. This has never happened in that time. the first, like, this is what I always think about when the Canadiens have any kind of success in the playoffs, is that we, this generation of Canadiens fans, the ones right now that are between the ages of, say, 15 and 30, are the first generation of Canadiens fans ever to not have a Stanley Cup experience with this team. They've never experienced success. It's the first unsuccessful generation of the Montreal Canadiens, like, basically in their history, but, or at least going back, you know, to like the 30s or the 20s. And so it's, I think of them in that moment, and I think of, I have to tell a story of what's going on here, and I can't miss anything. And my brain becomes somewhat paralyzed in that moment because I so want to see everything that I see nothing. So, like, you know, we're in the press box. We're really high up. I'm watching Weber. I'm watching Price. I'm watching Lehkonen, the celebration going on over there, trying to watch the bench, see what's going on over there. I'm all over the place. Ultimately, none of that stuff got into my story because I didn't absorb it. I wasn't able to absorb it. My mind was too consumed with telling this story properly. That's all that goes through my head when something like this happens.
Yeah, I was feeling exactly the same way. And I envy the fans who can just let it soak it all in. And being a fan of hockey and a fan of the Montreal Canadiens is what led me to become a sports writer. But once you start doing that job, you really cease being a fan. You stop being a fan. And there's that distance that you create, and it never goes away. And the more focused you are on reporting, telling the story, and observing, the more distance it creates with between the heart and the brain. Mm-hmm. And that's something that it's something that has changed me over time. So that's it. I mean, it's the first time that I lived the Montreal Canadiens reaching the Stanley Cup Finals live. And I remember when I was a kid, I was so much more excited when they did something similar or even less to a certain extent, you know? Less impressive, you know, just something that was, you know, in an earlier round or whatever, I would get more excited than I was yesterday. And that's just being so absorbed by the moment.
But that's what's important about the way we approach our jobs and the way that journalists have to do this, is that you have to remember that feeling. Like, you have to remember what it was like as a kid or as a teenager or as a young adult, whatever, what those moments meant to you, what you wanted to learn about them. You know, that's why whenever I enter the Canadiens dressing room, back when we could enter the Canadiens dressing room, that's what I try to keep in mind, is that I'm here on behalf of people like that. Like, that's my job. And so I can't be like that, because I need to try to think of what people want, and what do they want out of this experience? What do they want out of this moment? And it's so, like, I think a lot of people are always like, they kind of call bullshit on, like, oh, well, yeah, reporters say they can't be fans. Well, that's, how do you do that? That's impossible. It's not impossible. Listen, I was a diehard Canadiens fan when I grew up. When I was growing up, I loved the team to death. That's why I do what I do. I have my dream job, but it's a job, and it has to be done in a professional way. And you always have to be thinking about what kind of stories you want to tell. So when last night that happened, you know, I think that in a game in March, you know, I think that in a nothing throwaway game, you know, Habs Panthers in March, I'm thinking the same way. Like, how am I going to tell this story in a way that our readers want to read it, and how they want to consume it, what they want to know about it? But last night that went into, like, sensory overload, and it was just, there was a lot to take in. And there were, like, 15 different ways I or you or anyone could have gone to tell that story. But just think of all the good stories. Think of what we just talked about on this podcast. Like, I mean, you know, we could have written a story about Cole Caufield scoring on Robin Lehner after what Lehner said after game four, and what Caufield said the next day, and the way he scored it and everything. And just his story is phenomenal. It's incredible what's happened to him this year, when World Junior, Hobie Baker, first AHL game, scores in his first AHL game, playoffs, all this stuff. Excellent story. Price, Weber, Lehkonen, as we mentioned, Danault in his situation, Gallagher, there's so many stories that can be told. How do you pick one? What's the most important one? What matters right now? What does that kid who's watching this and who's losing his mind or her mind, what do they want to know about this? And that's, so, I mean, to whoever mentioned that to you, that's what goes on. It's not joy. It's utter anxiety. Like, it's just like a total overflowing anxiety that I got to nail this moment because this is a big moment. And you recognize it and you see cars burning outside and police cars being flipped. And why do we do this every time? Really, really bothers me. But you get the importance when the people in the Bell Center aren't allowed outside because people are celebrating too much. And so it's a big deal. And you got to try and nail it.
Well, as I wrote the other day, Quebecers handle their alcohol very well. Their hockey, not so much.
Yes. So. That's a great line.
So, yeah. But I think that one of the most important stories, you mentioned it, is the fact that there's a whole generation of fans that had never experienced that moment. And to a certain extent, you know, you could, maybe I'm digressing and making it a big social phenomenon here, but we're living in times where there's not a lot to cheer for anyway, you know, and not just in hockey, but yeah, in general. So it's a nice catharsis moment to say, okay, well, at least the hockey team enables us to cheer, to gather, even at the, you know, celebrating the end of a pandemic or pretending that it's over or whatever. But it's letting the steam out and letting just allowing us to celebrate and seize a moment where you can, there's that instinctive need inside everybody at some point to cheer, to joyce, to gather, and to experience something together. And those experiences are too far in between, you know, in sports and in other, you know, walks of life. But for the Montreal Canadiens to reach the Stanley Cup Finals and allowing that moment, not only yesterday, but that's the reality that we're going to be in for the next 10 days. It's quite joyful. That's the part I think that makes me the happiest.
Yeah, I'm happy for our city. I'm happy for Canadiens fans. I'm happy for people who haven't had a lot to be happy about. I agree with you 100%, and I think that's a perfect sentiment to leave this podcast on. But we'll be back. We will continue. Marc-Antoine and I will be discussing how we're going to approach the Stanley Cup Final from a podcast perspective, so stay tuned for some information on that. If you have not subscribed to The Athletic for some reason, now is absolutely the time to do so. Not only can you read Marc-Antoine and myself on the Canadiens, you will be able to read in-depth reporting on whoever they happen to face in the final, stories from around the league, the draft is coming up, free agency, everything you could possibly want for a hockey fan, everything you could possibly want as a sports fan. The Euros are going on, and our football coverage in Europe has been just off the charts amazing. So if you want to subscribe, go to theathletic.com/athletic support. That is theathletic.com/athletic support to get a discount on your first year. We will be back soon to discuss the start of the Stanley Cup Final featuring the Montreal Canadiens.